I'd like to call the meeting to order, and we have a quorum. So if we could do approval, if somebody would like to, okay. You'd like to, was that, Michael, you would like to do that, or?
That was a motion to approve the minutes.
A motion to approve the minutes dated March 22nd. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Wait, can I do that? Okay. So we have our esteemed chair here today to bring forward House File 1538. Would you like to
thank you, Madam Chair.
Bill?
And I'm very happy to present to the committee House File 1538. The motion I'd like to make, Madam Chair, is that this be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill, which members, by the way, we're not going to be doing this week as originally planned, but we'll do next week. So I'll give you more details when I have the gavel. But members will lay this over for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, proceed.
So members, I was contacted by the Minneapolis Public Schools, although this the scope of this bill is beyond Minneapolis. And we had a builds on a very successful collaboration that was done with the Metropolitan Council on discount bus passes for the homeless, which was included bipartisanly in some legislation that we passed a few years ago. And so this also deals with transit passes, and this would refer to students. And we've had a successful program in Minneapolis with students taking Metro buses, and I have a couple of testifiers who can tell you more details about it. So we have an appropriation. There's been some conversations with the Met Council, and I saw Mr. Shetman earlier.
He is not here. He's in Arizona.
Okay. But I believe that, you know, there is some consensus with the Met Council and their ability to do this. So, but I'll have Mr. Grathwall testify first and take it from here, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Grathwall?
Madam Chair and members, Jim Grathwall with the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'm as surprised to be testifying in front of the Transportation Finance Committee as you might be surprised to see me. Normally I haunt other committee hearings, but I'm really happy to be here. It's a first for me. But I'm
joined. Oh, you should bring cookies. I
damn.
Well,
it's
not a good bakery in Minneapolis.
No, we have several. I'll bring something from Patisserie 46 when this is put in the omnibus transportation finance bill.
That might be illegal, so I don't know. That would be a very good thing to do, but I'm not sure.
Representative Mahoney led me into sin and error, and I apologize. The 1538 proposes a conditional appropriation to the Metro Transit for to further subsidize this bus pass program. Let me introduce my associate and colleague Robert Johnson from Minneapolis Public Schools, who's going to have more. The questions you have are going to be answered by Mr. Johnson. I'd like to go into the story of kind of we're in the process of fully implementing a Metro Bus Pass program, which gives most of the students attending high school a Metro Bus Pass as their school bus transport. We've phased out at 5 of our high schools this year. Next year it will be all of our high schools and our contract alternatives and potentially open enrollment students will have the ability to use a Metro Pass, which we purchased from Metro Transit at a discount. This bill would deepen that discount so that about 8,700 students in Minneapolis would get to and from school on the Metro Pass. But beyond that, they get to and from other opportunities that enrich their education, enrich the asset building opportunities, whether that's education in and around the campus, staying for tutoring, staying for after school athletics, staying for clubs at campus, or going to educational opportunities beyond the campus, whether that's PSEO, museums, art, other cultural activities in the city of Minneapolis, and employment. Because for the most of our students, two-thirds of our students are free and reduced lunch eligible. Employment is a significant part of their life. And frankly, having students engage in employment delivers life skills that are very important for their success beyond just the income that employment generates. The currently, we've negotiated a $300 bus pass with the Metro Transit. This would be able to deepen that discount and really allow us to expand the program. Taking a step back and bringing you a little bit into K-12 transportation finance, the general ed formula funds transportation, school bus transportation for students at all public schools. We used to have a categorical transportation formula that was rolled into the general ed formula in the early 90s. At the time of that roll-in, it was rolled in at the statewide average cost. Minneapolis has always been a high-cost place to transport because of integration requirements, lakes, rivers, and streams, hazardous transportation. So the general ed, put it this way, Minneapolis public schools and the urban, generally urban and regional centers were losers on that statewide roll-in on an average cost. So our total transportation, and you have a handout in your packet, we have additional handouts here if you need them. Our total transportation budget is about $28 million if you look at that handout. And the, it's 27,476,000. The go-to pass is a part of that, and let me just close by saying this creates an opportunity for you to do this in Minneapolis. I think you'll see other cities across the state explore the viability, economic viability of running parallel bus systems, whether it's your school district and your metro transit or your regional transit systems. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have at this time. Mr. Johnson will probably be taking swings at most of those, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Mr. Grothog. We have a couple. Mr. Chair, I'm going to get your advice. Would you like to go on to your next testifier and then take questions, or what would be the best way to handle this?
It sounds like I don't know if Mr. Johnson's here to answer questions or had some additional testimony. It's up to our panel here to decide. It sounded like from Mr. Grathwall's comments that Mr. Johnson would probably be answering some technical questions related to this.
Okay, so I am terribly flexible. So if you would like a general program overview and before you ask questions, I can provide that. If you would just like to ask questions, then.
And Mr. Johnson, could you please state your name?
I'm sorry, Robert Johnson, Director of Administrative Operations, Minneapolis Public Schools.
Okay, thank you. Did you want to make a couple comments before we move into questions?
Okay, so the Go-To-Pass program was piloted in Minneapolis public schools with open enrolled programs. As you know, historically, Minneapolis public schools had students transported across the city for a myriad of programs. In an effort to reduce reduce transportation costs and give students greater access, a program was piloted in cooperation with the Met Council to give students Metro Transit cards to allow them to use the city bus and train systems to transport to and from school as well as other educational opportunities. What we realized from that pilot was that students overwhelmingly self-selected and opted into much more educational opportunities than students who had traditional yellow busing. That was because if you rode a yellow bus, you had to be at school when the bus got there, you had to leave when the bus left. If you didn't do that, you couldn't. If you didn't have alternative transportation, such as if your mom didn't give you a car, or one of your friends didn't have a car, or your mother or father couldn't afford to buy you a bus card, you didn't have the opportunity to participate unless the school had enough discretionary funding to buy buses for after school activities. And what we realized is that once we opened up that door to students, they went to museums, they went to libraries, they stayed for tutoring, they stayed for mentoring, they got there early for coaching. They self-selected to engage in lots of educational opportunities. So the superintendent and board at Minneapolis Public Schools decided that for this current school year, which is 12-13, that we would roll it out to five of our comprehensive high schools. The decision was based primarily on economic need. The two schools that aren't participating this year are South and Southwest. We did a student survey that showed undeniably students see the value in it and love it. Actually, over 90% of students select that they like or love the program. We had students who overwhelmingly said that it was that they had a comfortable and easy to use system. 96% of kids said that they liked it much better than they thought it would be. So this program actually broke down a barrier to the perception of public transportation, which opens the door for another generation of transit users. Mm-hmm. The statistics are, I'm not going to read them verbatim to you. They're all here, and every one of them points to the same target, which is students overwhelmingly appreciate it and use the program to get for their primary goal to get to and from school, and for the second order goal, which is to allow them to engage in other opportunities to educate themselves and become much better citizens of our communities. In terms of spending, this program is, this year was $1.34 million. The bulk of that cost goes purely to purchasing cards and fees associated with swapping out cards as kids lose them or students come leave and come into the district. That accounts for $1.2 million of the $1.34
million. Okay.
Next year, our projected cost is about $2.6 million. About $2.6 of that is buying cards. So the vast bulk of the cost of this program is purely in purchasing the cards from Metro Transit. So any subsidy that will be incurred would really go a long way toward helping us expand this program and helping the students of Minneapolis.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know this is a bill that's going to be laid over, but I'm not feeling your pain. As a school district that gets about half as much money as you do in Rochester, and it's exciting. But if I was in high school, I would rather ride a cool-looking Metro bus versus a yellow bus, too. My concern is, are we saving money by not contracting as many yellow buses, or are we just adding additional passes and the yellow buses are still running simultaneously similar routes than they always have, because not everybody's going to ride the other bus? And if indeed you're saving money, where does that fit in? And I have a follow-up about the last time we went to Metro expecting that there would be a fare increase. Promise was broken. So I'll follow up with that.
And who would like to answer that question, Mr. Groffel?
Representative Benson, we own and operate about one-third of our buses and contract out about two-thirds of our buses. For us in transportation in Minneapolis Public Schools, the ability to reduce the number of buses, so again, we're moving our high schools off yellow bus transportation, which has resulted in a reduction in the number of some buses and bus routes. But the real way to reduce the number of buses and bus routes, we have five different start times across the city, and it's attacking that start time issue, the bell time issue, is how we reduce both the contracted and or the own district owned and operated. I'm going to ask Robert to respond to the cost savings that we may have incurred so far in this program, but my understanding is the real way for us to reduce the cost savings on running the yellow bus fleet, which we're going to continue to run for elementary, is to attack the bell start time issue.
So in implementing this program, we have a projected savings of, I think, $320,000 to about $500,000. But that was immediately reabsorbed elsewhere, primarily because of what Jim said, bell times. We had schools shifting bell times at the same time we rolled this program out. And like I said, we run a ton of buses. And even by taking out five high schools or even seven high schools, the number of buses doesn't drop, just the number of routes drops. So until we can consolidate those bell times, it's really difficult to see a tremendous amount of savings. And it makes it very difficult just because of the sheer limited amount of buses in the city of Minneapolis. I mean, we transport...
Madam Chair and Representative, about 28,400 students are on bus transportation out of 34,000.
And so the different bell times allow us to essentially use all those buses to get all the kids there on time. We can't consolidate it too much because there's just not enough capacity to get all those kids on buses for one start time, is what it boils down to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson. And Representative Benson, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I guess I'm thank you for your explanation. I guess I'm not buying into a plan that doesn't accommodate remedying those things in the future. I mean, you're asking the taxpayers of the Minneapolis area to cough up another $2.5 million. Laudable goals, great to get kids to activities and so on, but I don't see the efficiencies potential being addressed simultaneously with the starts and so on. But I'll leave that. I'm sure there'll be potentially other people that will chime in. This would be to the author of the bill, and that is, who promised you the quarter increase, and do you really expect that you'll get it?
Okay, so that's a, Madam Chair. So this is a key question, and that's why, on 1-9, page 1, line 9. It's a new expense in that this is contingent on the metro sales tax increase being implemented. So this is not going to, appropriation will not happen if for some reason, oh my gosh, I think I just divulged something that might be in the bill and it's not out yet. No, I'm joking.
I know I spent a lot of time, Mr. Chair.
If the chair decides in the next couple of days to include a half-cent increase in the metro sales tax for transit and the legislature does not approve that or the governor doesn't sign it, this bill will not happen. So, I mean, it's a good catch that you made, Representative Benson, and I think one worth noting, that this is completely contingent on this new appropriation. We're not taking anything existing away from the Met Council.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to say that we are,
Mr. Johnson,
we are in the midst of consolidating our bell times, but it's not something that can be done right away. We have to engage parents, and because bell times directly affect how parents and families arrange their days and their work schedules and their daycare schedules. So I can say with all certainty right now we are absolutely addressing bell times and how to consolidate them and pack them in tighter. So that's not something that's lost on us, and we are operating in a manner to address that directly.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Okay, and Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm not sure who to address this to, but maybe Chair Hornstein can tell me too, because the bill, it sounds like there's some exciting opportunities here for at least the metropolitan area. And being that I've been on the school boards for a long time, I can tell the two of you that outstate and those that don't have a metro system of buses have the same concerns about if they don't have buses, they can't do it. I guess my question gets to be even more fundamental, which is, it seems to me this is an educational policy and finance issue and not a transportation issue itself, because we do put into the budget, educational budget, dollars for transportation of students. And so I'm wondering why it's coming here. It almost seems like it could be kind of an end run around the financing of their educational system for transportation. And so I'm curious as to why this would be addressed here rather than the education budget.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Petersburg, again, that's an excellent question. The reason that the bill is here is that this talks about an appropriation from the Metropolitan Council. And so this is, and it talks about the funding source being the sales tax in the metro area. So those are transportation finance related questions. I guess there's a legitimate issue here around education policy, but I think it's really, it comes to us, and once in a while we get these. I think this is the first one this year. But once in a while we'll get something related to the schools, and this is very much in our purview because of the financing mechanism for the past. I don't know if Mr. Rathbaud wanted to comment on the education piece.
Mr. Rathbaud.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think what I find in the 15 years I've worked with the Minneapolis Public Schools is We're an education organization. We're a transportation organization. We deliver food service. We deliver health care. We stop at housing, but we deal with transportation of homeless, highly mobile. So we think of the Little Red Schoolhouse, but the service delivery that supports the academic goals of our kids, you know, are in a bunch of different silos. And this does represent moving across these silos or these platforms and recognizing, is it efficient to run yellow school buses when we have a metro transit system that can deliver that for our high school students? We're finding that going to metro transit for our high school students supports the academic goals, supports their life skills, and that's why we're coming here. The appropriation is conditional to metro transit, that then we would negotiate that deeper discount on that high school transportation. So while it is public school transportation, it's much more than that for the students, but we're finding that Rob has a very interesting fact that we looked in the analytics and found that there's a bunch of students taking metro transit during the middle of the day. Where are they going? It turns out they're not going to the Mall of America. They're going to PSEO. They're going to their higher education classes. So it gives us great tools. It expands the school day, the learning day, which is what we need to do to close the achievement gap and really keep students engaged. And if we can reach out to a partner like Metro Transit to help deliver on the goals Minneapolis Public Schools is committed to achieving, we're going to do that. And you may see me here more than once. But I think this is an innovative program. I think we'll see replication of this in other districts if we're able to succeed with this. And it really does support the learning goals of our students.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Peters.
Yeah, I'll just follow up with one more question, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. I think this is very innovative, and I think you have a great opportunity here. But I think the fundamental issue gets back to what you said earlier in the early 90s when transportation was rolled into the general operating expense. This kind of gives an unfair advantage to the Minneapolis district compared to other districts, or especially like state Minnesota, where your transportation is already included in your general budget, and now most of these cards would be taken out of your budget without changing in funding sources. And so it seems to me that this is, again, a way in which it's not necessarily addressing equitably and fairly across the state. So,
okay, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Chair, this is a question for you. Prior to that, unfortunately, the chair of the bonding committee, who is a member of this committee, is busy elsewhere, so she can't be here. $2.5 million buys a lot of bonds over a year. I can't remember whether it's $10 million or $100 million is what it pays for. My understanding with the sales tax for transit was for build out. So what line doesn't get built?
Mr. Chair.
So, and we'll be delving into this in much more detail next week, but Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, there are two uses for the sales tax. One is for what you had described, which is building out transitways. The other is Metropolitan Council transit operations. And so this is related to that budget. We are making some pretty major changes. And again, without divulging too much, of course, it's probably the best kept secret around here. One of the many best kept secrets is that, we are going to promote a sales tax for transit in the metropolitan area, but it's going to also cover some operations that's currently in the general fund. So that's, that would be the pot of money that this would come from, not from the transit.
Representative Mahoney.
So, I'm quick calculation off the top of my head. There's 300 and some odd school districts around the state. I got to believe there's a significant number in the metro area. You're taking a significant amount of money away from, I don't know the secret of what the split of any kind of transit tax we would do, operations versus build-out. But all of a sudden, you're sucking up a lot of that money with the schools. And, you know, I don't want to pick on another chair on, you know, at the table, but this is a Pandora's box that you open. And, I mean, St. Paul could do this, North St. Paul, Anoka, everybody else, and all of a sudden, you're not talking a 2.5, you're talking $25 or $30 million a year out of this to cover transportation costs, or even more.
Chair Hornstein?
Madam Chair, and that's why we have hearings. And I think I'm going to take some of these comments that I'm hearing today and discuss these with Mr. Grathwell. You know, the model that worked that I'm hoping that can be replicated here is the model that we used for the discount passes for the homeless. And that actually did start off as a much smaller pilot project. And, you know, that may be something that we do here. And that's why I wanted to, you know, this bill came, towards the end of March and thought it was a good idea, and I wanted it to get vetted through this committee because I strongly agree with the goals of this. Maybe we start up as a smaller pilot project, I'm not sure, but I do think that this idea of having students, take advantage of our regular route metro transit bus service to provide greater flexibility and in their schedules and take some pressure off of the, I think it's a laudable goal to start to phase out the yellow bus service for high schools and in our city. So, you know, I think there's a lot of good goals here, and you know, how we do it and how we deal with the limited resources that we have is a very valid and legitimate question. So that's why I wanted to have this hearing today. And I'm used to the fact that you bring Minneapolis stuff before the legislature. There's always going to be a lot of questions because we have a lot of unique situations in our city, i.e. the park dedication fee. So, so this is, again, one of these things, and I do really appreciate the committee's time and all of your questions. So I'm learning, you know, it's really helpful, so thank you.
We are having a lively conversation here today, and Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and can you tell me how many empty classrooms the Minneapolis school system has? I know a couple years ago it was more than 3,000.
Madam Chair and members, I don't have that off the top of my head. We've had a number of buildings that we've sold, closed, some are moving back online, so I can get you that information. We've gone through enrollment gains in the 90s, declines, and post 9/11. We've been in a decline rate now. We're at about a steady state, and it's always matching facility and matching facility to parent choice of where they want their students is an ongoing issue. I'd be happy to get that to you tomorrow.
And I think, you know, we all know that Minneapolis schools get the highest per pupil reimbursement of any school district in the state, and for a variety of reasons, some of them very valid, some of them maybe not. Suburban districts have learned if you don't have about 800 to 900 kids in an elementary school at the rate in which they get per pupil funding, they can't cash flow the infrastructure, the janitor, the principal, the support staff that you need for a school. Certainly, my friends in Greater Minnesota knows what happens with declining enrollments when you get your numbers down in your schools and have to keep all that infrastructure going. And I'm coming from a district that Lakeville Area Schools was the largest land area of any school district in the state of Minnesota before consolidations. And so our transportation costs are through the ceiling, where we go all the way out to Elko and almost to Prior Lake and quite a large area. So for different reasons. And in our district, if you live within 2 miles of your school, you get no transportation. And I'm guessing the majority of your students live within 2 miles of these schools, and the parents pay more than a couple $100 a year, and if they want their kids to ride a bus. And so I'm kind of scratching my head with this one. I don't see any offset in the general pupil formula, which by your own testimony includes money for transportation. You want this on top of all the other money that you're getting. I guess I'd be much more interested in a program like this if it was more a subsidizing of student fares across the metro for some of these purposes rather than an add-on on top of the money you're already getting that's supposed to pay for your transportation costs. And I'm not trying to minimize the challenges, but you have way more money than most to address the challenges. And it's never good to speak against the chair's bill. You never really want to do that, but I think it probably needs a little more work, and I don't know why the taxpayers of the metropolitan area should pay twice just for bus passes for students in one district if this is such a good thing and has so many benefits for our young learners. Maybe there's an ability to put together a program for student bus passes. But if there is some kind of direct subsidy just to one school district, it should in no way pay the entire cost, but rather there should be some offset with the money you're already getting under the general ed formula for transportation.
Well, I did not hear a question on that, but I see that Chair Hornstein is eager to comment on that.
No, I'm just thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just eager to say that you'll have plenty of opportunities to attack a chair's bill next week. But it's good to practice. But I do feel, Representative Holbrook, that you raised some very important points, particularly about, you know, that this has a regional potential, and how it's funded is an important question as well. And so again, that's why, you know, it's really great to get some initial comments. That's why we wanted to have the hearing, and I'll have a lot of ideas, I think, you know, moving forward for Mr. Rathwell, and, you know, whether we do it this session or work with some education finance folks and the other committee. I mean, that's an interesting idea as well. So, you know, we're noting things here, and I would, you know, appreciate again any additional ideas that you have. But I want to just let everybody know it is totally fine, freshmen especially, totally fine to
and Madam
speak
Chair,
against the chair's bill.
Representative, for clarification purposes on your go-to pass budget, I'm assuming your first box here should be 2012-2013. Is that correct?
Okay. So we have three more people on our wanted to ask questions or make comments. I'm not sure what they will be, but Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Hornstein, when I first read through that and heard the testimony, I was thinking this is a brilliant idea. The concept is a wonderful concept, because anytime we can provide the students with more opportunity, you know, they're going to be more involved. I'm just thinking about in the area in which I represent, you know, we have farm students. There are many of those farm kids that after school, they'd come over to our house and hang out until the basketball game or whatever, right? They had that. If they weren't able to do that, they wouldn't be out for some of the sports. And so anything that we can do to provide those students with more opportunities. When I was first thinking of this concept, I thought that we'd be able to book savings. I remember Speaker Swigum would always say, I saw that bus and there's only one person on that bus. You know, you probably remember that too. And so we do have an opportunity there. And so I guess I think if we would dig into this and we're able to reduce the yellow fleet, if you will, and to do something like this, that there probably could be some long-term savings is what I was originally thinking. What would it take to make that leap? My question would be, what would it take to make that leap to do away with the yellow buses and go specifically to something like this? Could we do that? And then what would be the long-term savings to the school district in the event we did something like that?
Mr. Grathwald?
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Hamilton, great questions. And these the transportation issue is very complex in all our districts. So I appreciate those comments. This has been our attempt to solve some of that. I don't think we're ever going to put kindergartners on the Metro Transit bus. So where we are in this evolution from homeless kids to some of our high schools to all of our high schools is thinking our high school students are loving this and are demonstrating they're using it responsibly, and it is successful in keeping them engaged. So just remember, the world is changing. K-12 is going to change. High school certainly is going to change. And we have to find ways to keep students engaged for more time, because the key is more time on task. So if I can keep them at campus in an academic pursuit, whether that's robot club or whatever, but the and other academic opportunities throughout the city and employment is really important for the students we serve. The key for us in controlling the our regular fee and finding savings there is, again, the bell times. And folks, we have our own sparsity issues in transportation. One of the benefits of Minneapolis and having all that revenue for pupil is we also have mandates that aren't associated, have no revenue associated. So the 4,140 homeless, highly mobile students that we transport around the city and to other school districts, half of them to other school districts, that's $1.4 million. No federal, no money associated. That's great policy. It's a good thing to do. Those buses aren't as full as they could be, and I think we should be grateful that they aren't as full. I think 4,000 at the Moorhead or a Wilmer. That's enough homeless, highly mobile students in the state. So for us, we have to stack the bell time to create efficiency in delivering buses to routes so that someone on the first tier can show up. Maybe if it's a short run, they can make it into the second tier. If it's a long run, they make it into the third tier. So it's a very complex business that has competing tensions associated with it. We stack the bell times to create efficiencies, and if we can get more, all of our high school students off onto the Metro Transit, I think that it's better for them, and I think eventually we can start to work some of our start times around the Netflix, Mr. Johnson had see as start times and moving to fewer staff.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Petersburg, and then we have Representative O'Neill. Would you like to yield to Representative O'Neill right now,
sure.
If you don't mind? That would be good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So behind me, I have the St. Michael's School District. You guys want to raise up your funding for their funding? So, Minneapolis, I want you to hear that this school district, do you know how much they get per pupil? You guys want to tell them? $6,712, I believe, they get per pupil. Do you know what you guys get per pupil?
Madam
Mr. Grothwell.
About $14,000, depending on how you count.
Yeah, depending on how you count. So, say $14,000. That's a nice number compared to $6,700.
Representative O'Neill.
And they're actually here today to talk about equity in education. And when I said, well, we're in here talking about Minneapolis right. School District with like another $2.5 million to pay for their, there are some more people from St. Michael coming in. They would like another $2.5 million to help fund their transportation system. They all gasped when they were in the hallway with me. So I thought I'd bring in a demonstration from Greater Minnesota as they hold up their funding for fairly funding schools. They're one of the poorest in the state.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a question for the testifiers?
Well, I guess I want to know, where is the justification for double dipping? You already receive it in the school funding formula, and now you're coming here and asking for another $2.5 million. What's your justification for that?
Mr. Grothwell.
Madam Chair, Representative, and I have the opportunity to make this case more often in the education finance system, and I let off with, it's kind of an interesting experience for me to be in front of the Transportation Finance Committee. It's a first in 15 years with Minneapolis schools. The characteristics of schools across the state differ, and our education finance system addresses many of those. I think Minneapolis public schools would have support equitable funding of all schools. There's equity in property tax base. There's equity in responsibility to serve all kids. So I think I mentioned very briefly, in Minneapolis, we serve, just so far in this year, 4,140 identified by December 31st, homeless, highly mobile kids, half of whom attend other schools. We're driving kids out to Elk River, and that's a transportation cost of $1.4 million. That's part of the increase, or the delta in differential. 68% of our students are free and reduced lunch. 19% of our students are special education. We have the largest special ed cross subsidy. We have students. There's been a 40-year consensus of public policy that where there are students with greater needs, you should apply greater resource. I think that's a good public policy, and most of the states across the nation move in that direction. Notwithstanding that consensus, there are still equity issues which we would support resolving for St. Michael and other districts.
Okay, Mr. Chair Hornstein.
And I thank you, and thanks for the question, and welcome to the committee. I'm the chair, so thank you for coming. But I don't want to necessarily go down this road, but I think it's because we're in the Transportation Finance Committee, it does deserve mention. You know, there's been a historical gripe for many years that I think bipartisanly in the metro area we have concerns about related to the county state aid formula, for example. And I think you could go through the state budget on every single area, whether it's health care, education, or transportation, and we can find fault in the metro area with how much we subsidize Greater Minnesota and roads. And Greater Minnesota can find fault in some of these education formulas. And these exist. We have tremendous rifts in our budget, and I can tell you, you know, when we had these highway engineers come from up north and talk about how upset they were with the CASA formula, I warned them to not go there. And this is something that unites Representative Beard and Representative Holberg and I. And so we have inequities, and there's anyone can plead unfairness, and everyone can take just a little strand of one budget and one area and make a case and start dividing people. And I just don't think that's really helpful or healthy. And so what I'd like to do is, again, we have an idea before us, an idea that has a lot of merit, an idea that there are legitimate concerns about in this committee. And we'll go back and we'll figure out a way to model a partnership between not only the Minneapolis School District, but I think school districts in certainly the region and, if possible, around the state, to utilize our public transportation systems to the benefit of public school students so that they have the kinds of opportunities that Representative Hamilton talked about. And so, again, I referred to this before when it came up earlier in another context, but you know, we had a One Minnesota conference at the beginning of the session, and we're One Minnesota for that day. But I hope that we can be One Minnesota beyond that day. And while we have differences and we have gripes, and we have issues with how things are funded, we do need to figure out ways to address those, as Mr. Rathwell said, but also to understand that we have unique issues in our areas. And if we start going down the line of, well, I don't want to fund your township road because there's only one car on it per week, you know, then we get into a lot of issues. So I just, you know, I appreciate your bringing that. I appreciate all of you folks coming. And again, we'll probably make some changes to this bill if, in fact, it is incorporated in the.
Representative Petersburg, did you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. This is just a clarification question, one that, because I'm not real sure about this, but the question that I would ask, is there anything, and it's for any one of the three testifiers, is there any statute or law or rule currently in place that would preclude Minneapolis from being able to do this under their own general budgeting formula as well?
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, we're actually doing it without statutory authority. What this is, we've negotiated one deal with Metro Transit. So remember, looking at the length of the bill, conditional appropriation should there be in the future an increase in Metro Transit sales tax, conditional appropriation to Metro Transit to be able to negotiate a better deal to allow us to expand this program. And when we talk about expanding the program, this year's seniors are next year's transit riders. So part of the way this funds itself is that there'll be increased ridership because we're creating a generation of transit savvy students who are going to be on the buses for the rest of their life. So I think a key component of this, if we did, what do we call it in the federal budgeting, there's a special term for projecting out 10 years. This will educate and train generations of transit riders that will increase ridership and pay off this and that.
Okay. And then before we continue on, I just want to welcome our guests in the audience and let people know that in the rules of the House are the no signs in the committee room. So I just want to bring that to your attention out of respect to the rest of the people in the committee. So thank you very much for honoring that. Representative Hausman and then Representative Hamilton, we can do a follow-up, but we do want to wrap up this part of it so we can move on to our agenda. It's Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to our guests, you've just had a prime example of how you've in a sense been used for fighting out our little regional war here in a committee, and you were the poster child for one side of that argument. I don't know if it was clear to the guests here, but what funds this is not education money from everybody. What funds this is a 7-county metro area sales tax, which we may raise only in the 7-county metro area. And what we would use it for is 2.5 of that could buy bus passes for kids in school who could use that bus. And I think it's important for us to look at your statistics. One of the things you point out is if they have, these are kids probably whose parents can't drive them after school to after school activities. And you've given us some increases in participation in those after school activities that are possible because they now have a way to get there and to get home safely. And I think it's important for us to understand that when you fund a little bit here, you might save a huge amount. And here is the research that I think is important to talk about. Being involved in after-school activities, and this is not my research, this is research that is proved, it does three things. It enhances academic achievement, it prevents teenage pregnancy, it prevents crime. Being involved in after-school activities in constructive ways. All expensive problems to society as a whole. But if we do something in a different way, maybe we more productively involve people. And I just think it's always important for us to understand that sometimes providing different opportunities prevents more expensive problems.
Okay. Representative Hausman, that was a comment. Yes, thank you. Representative Hamilton, final question.
Yes, and once again, I just want to reiterate, I think this is excellent. And, you know, to provide these students, and we will reap benefits as a state long term. The whole thing is, I think that we could approach this, or I'd encourage us approaching this a little bit differently, to where we could capture those savings and actually look towards a reduction in cost by doing this and utilizing the existing transit system. I think that there could be some savings there. So then we won't have this issue about raising additional revenues and stuff like that. Again, I think this whole concept is a great one, and we need to figure out how to do it. And so I guess that's a comment, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And Chair Hornstein, would you like to summarize your bill? And
Madam Chair, thank you. I mean, again, this is the purpose of a hearing like this, to hear concerns. This is a little outside the box, even for things that I propose. So your indulgence is appreciated. And I think, again, we're going to go back, we're going to discuss this, and I do think that, as Mr. Rathwell said, we've got to acknowledge that things are changing, and we have some unique issues in Minneapolis that are different from other school districts, but we also have a lot of things in common. And so, you know, if we can figure out a way to build on the success, we're talking about a success story that we want to build on, and if we can build on the success here and replicate it in other areas, I think it's a net benefit. And I think Representative Hausman's point is, again, very well taken. I'd made it earlier. I want to reiterate, because this was not a very helpful demonstration of unity here. This has nothing to do with funding formulas for school districts. And so, we want to keep that in mind. There is a legitimate question that Representative Mahoney raised, and that is, is this how we want to spend our sales tax money? And that's legitimate, that's valid, and we need to think through that. At first blush, the Met Council is okay with it, but, they may not be next week. So we need to think that through a little bit more. So there's a lot more that has to go into this, members, and I just, again, want to just thank you for a really good discussion and really good ideas, and that's why we do this. So, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the gavel.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and to our testifiers. We're going to move on to our next bill. And so we are, just before we conclude, we're going to, this is going to be laying this over for possible inclusion in the transportation finance bill. So we will switch the gavel here and put the chair back in his spot.
Representative Lohmer, thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
And members, I'll just say that we just have a bill in front of us that hasn't been formally introduced. That's correct?
Correct.
And so this is an informational hearing, and we're going to have another informational hearing tomorrow on one of my initiatives. So again, this is something we do. Bill doesn't necessarily have to be jacketed or introduced. I want to accommodate members who have ideas to share, and this is a good one. So thank you for coming to the committee, and welcome. And we'll proceed with our informational hearing on reimbursement of fire and ambulance services on interstate highways.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to this idea, and we should have the jackets today, we're hoping, so that'll be good, and we'll get it dropped this week. But and thank you, members, for hearing. The Lower St. Croix Valley Fire Department came to me several years ago about a situation where the taxpayers of several small communities in my district have been expected to shoulder the costs when this fire department is mandated to answer calls on the Highway 90, I-94, Interstate 94 corridor between Woodbury and Hudson, Wisconsin. The annual cost to these communities is approximately $20,000 to $40,000 per year, or roughly 8 to 12% of their budget. This is not a large sum of money from a state perspective, but for these communities and taxpayers, it's a burden that quite frankly should not be borne by these folks. So last session, we were given money for a study on this issue, just to look at it from a statewide perspective. So today I have with me Chief Jim Stanley from the Lower St. Croix Valley Fire Department, and also Buck McAlpin from the Minnesota Ambulance Association, who will discuss what that study found. So thank you, Jim.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Jim Stanley. I'm Deputy Chief with the Lower St. Croix Valley Fire. And the issue that we have at hand is providing a safe work environment for our employees on an interstate. It's rather expensive. What we end up doing is using multiple engines and a tender or tanker for blockers to create that safe work zone. It isn't just to provide the work zone for the ambulance or our firefighters. It's also to provide a safe work zone for state patrol or any law enforcement that might be responding to the situation. For reconstruction specialists in the event of a larger incident, and right down to the tow truck drivers. It used to be where we would get on the highway, take care of business, and State Patrol was kicking us off because we were creating, the gawkers were looking, we were creating a distraction. And now it's the idea of State Patrol that they don't want us to leave until they're safely off on the highway and the incident's been mitigated totally. The program or the policy that we have and most departments do throughout the state of Minnesota is staging vehicles like within a mile of the incident. You have a pre-warning emergency vehicle marking that there's an incident ahead. And then you slowly have your taper zone where you slowly move the traffic over into one or two lanes of traffic. And then you have your blockers that actually protect the workers while on the scene. We all know with the distracted drivers, with everybody in between the texting, the cell phones, and whatever else people do on their way to work, everybody on their tight schedule, running late, people are very impatient, and things are very dangerous out there. I know with the State Patrol that every taxpayer in the state of Minnesota, regardless of whether they have an interstate running through their area or a highway, through paying taxes, they support the State Patrol. And in our situation, we provide emergency services on 94, and it's totally the burden of our taxpayers within our community just because of the way the boundaries go. The issue with responding on an interstate versus a regular highway, or even as you get into your larger metropolitan areas, we have higher speeds. We don't have the Jersey barricade running down, so we have open medians. So if we had an incident in a median, we actually have to double our protection. We have to get it both east and west on, which doubles the amount of apparatus we need on the scene. So it's rather expensive for our smaller paid-on-call fire departments. Your full-time departments have staff that are there getting paid no matter if they go out or not. And, you know, we're paying our staff only in the event of emergency when we're up on the highway. It doesn't matter if we get up there and we evaluate the patient, the ambulance takes off, doesn't transport, we're still up on the highway, we're set up, and we're protecting the state patrol and law enforcement the entire time we're up there. So,
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McAlpin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for hearing this discussion today. From the Ambulance Association side, we had to apologize to Representative Lohmer. The Ambulance Association was appropriated $10,000 last year. Mr. Doyle worked on this, representing our Ambulance Association. He went on a long-term medical leave throughout the session, and we finished his report later than what was required of January 1. So we kind of came to the table late with Representative Lohmer and the fire chief here on working to what we could put together with some language. And there is some draft language that's in front of you. We appreciate the discussion. And we worked through from about January for the first couple months doing the report to try to get some accurate numbers. In Minnesota, we have 8 regional EMS systems. Fire systems sit in there, ambulance systems, first responders. Some are affiliated with fire or with municipalities. Some are standalone. And as many of you know, we have all types of ambulance operations, from municipal-based, fire-based, not-for-profits, hospital-based, and our air medical system sits in that too. But our primary focus with this study to look at is the ambulance industry, and this study shows about $272 million of uncompensated care for the ambulance side of it, and over $14 million for the fire side. But the ambulance industry has a little bit more recourse to collect, and we have very short times on interstate highways. As Jim talked about, they can spend hours and hours and hours providing safety on the scene. We're on the ambulance side, whether it's our helicopters that come in or our ambulances. We're in and we're out, and we clear out of the area. So the interesting thing, and I won't go through the whole part of the survey, but we're seeing an increase of about 14,000 uncompensated calls every year out of 126 that was reported. And this was about a 20-plus percent survey result responded out of about 2,200 surveys that we sent out through our large survey monkey tree. So it was pretty interesting when we looked at it. But we knew that the fire service, as the chief talked about, did not have the ability to go out and collect that revenue and try to get that from patients. They can bill. Sometimes if you do submit a statement, somebody will pay under their auto insurance, or just privately they may pay for the response. And we know that even the $500 number that we put into the draft legislation, we looked at some stuff that's done with Wisconsin on interstate highways, and that's where we kind of came up with that number to put that in there. We've talked to all the states around Minnesota the last few years about reciprocity and how we work on things, from collecting ambulance cross-border claims and fire claims for incidents like this. We think this falls out of the purview of what's a normal taxpayer responsibility, as Jim talked about, with a local fire protection, as they kind of get to be a resource to the state when they're on the interstate highway. The interesting thing is about 12%, we calculated in the survey, of all their runs are to interstate, and that's statewide. That's not just Minnesota, or not just Jim's service area, but about 12% across the state when fire and first responders respond, it's to some type of interstate highway system. And under conclusions that we looked at, we talked about uncompensated care pools, define emergency response more, work the Department of Human Services to reimburse for first responder. I think we all know in the Health and Human Services, it's a very tough thing. We continue to see a decrease in how any of us are paid. About 72% of all responses that we go to, whether it's in the medical business, is underpaid of what our costs are to respond to it. That's why your health insurance premiums are so high, and like anything, that shift takes place in healthcare. But from the Ambulance Association standpoint, and why we're working on this with the fire chiefs, is that the safety aspect of it is very important to us. Our ambulances are good size, but they're not as good as a fire truck with a 1,000-gallon tank of water in the back, as they protect that whole entire scene as cars come by at some pretty high rate of speeds. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'd sure take some questions, and we'll leave the reports for folks to look at, but we look forward to working on this issue.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? I know we have a few already. Representative Mahoney first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the fire chief, or I'll phrase the question this way. Page 1, line 19, you have the $500 figure in there. Is this for one or the other or both to be split? You know, how does that work? I'm not quite sure about that.
Representative and Mr. Chair, the $500 figure, like Mr. McAlpine talked about, was something that was taken off the Wisconsin program. And what we're not looking for full compensation. We're looking for just some help. And that $500, going by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and FEMA. They have a fee schedule of $300 per engine, and they have a fee schedule of $200 per tender tanker, and then specialty vehicles and chief vehicles and all of that. And so it gets rather expensive, so that there had to be a cap on it. And what we're looking for is mainly for personnel costs, for fuel, for, you know, some wear and tear on the vehicle. We're not looking for full compensation necessarily, because it would be rather expensive.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't catch your name.
I'm sorry. My name is Jim Stanley.
Jim Stanley?
Yes.
Mr. Stanley, Assistant Chief Stanley. You know, this would be, what would be helpful here is to have your average cost for a run. And I know a run with a dozen cars in a crack up is going to be a whole lot more expensive than somebody just running into a ditch and you have to go and put a Band-Aid on their forehead and send them on, wait for the tow truck. And, but an average would be good for us to kind of have a spot for this. You know, I'm an urban legislator. I've got, you know, we just pay this out of our property taxes or wherever, but I understand Greater Minnesota has some issues with it. So that would be one. The other is the language on page 2, line 6, after the commissioner, it kind of goes to after you, if the commissioner has reimbursed the fire department shall provide the amount collected to the commissioner up to the amount of the reimbursement. Because I was wondering there, you know, if you collected $5,000 from the insurance company, you're going to just hand over the $5,000 to the commissioner. You know, I've got some relatives in small towns. They're a little more tight-fisted than us urban liberals. But thank you. I think you covered that.
Good question.
Proceed.
Mr. Representative, it averages $850 per hour per call. A lot of times it doesn't matter if there's six vehicles or if there's one vehicle. We have to have the same system set up. Like I stated, that would be blocking one lane. If it's in the median, that price would almost double. And a lot of the insurance companies will allow you to charge for rescue response. And this is the way I understand it, and this is what we've had luck with, is only the vehicle who's actually had hands-on with the patient or provided a service that helped get the patient out of the vehicle. So the warning vehicles down the highway, all our blockers that we're putting out are non-billable as far as the insurance companies go. And in our situation, doesn't fall with everyone, but our situation, we have a lot of traffic from Wisconsin. We're being right on the border, and so many of them are uninsured, and their ambulance coverage is covered through their major medical, but so there is no billable insurance company for rescue. Major medical won't bill or won't pay for rescues.
Another reason why I don't like Wisconsin.
But
you need a toll. No insurance. Thank you. Yes.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having served on a number of different departments, my question, I know there's a whole lot of different policies out there as far as what some departments try to get reimbursement, some departments don't. In the study, is there anywhere in here, and I just perused it here just recently, but is there anything in there that talks about the number of departments and the number of departments that try to receive compensation and those that don't? Because some have a policy that they do try to receive compensation from insureds, and some, as the departments that I worked on, chose not to try and get reimbursement. So my question is what, you know, there's a large number here of uncompensated claims. How many of those actually try to get compensation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, we did not dig into the numbers or if each individual department billed with the size of the survey response that we put out, but we do know a fair number of them do not bill. Most of fire departments are not billing for services, even first response. Cities the size of Minneapolis very aggressively bill for first responder. There's nothing in law that precludes them from billing for services, but unlike the ambulance industry, we're required by law to be paid within 30 days for clean claims, and the fire service and the first responders have no requirement to be reimbursed.
And members, before I get to Representative Beard and Representative Holberg has a question too, I want to welcome our ex officio member, Ways and Means Chair, Representative Carlson. You know, when he walks in, it's sort of like the assistant principal coming in. So I really, really hope I'm not in trouble. But I want to welcome him because I know that you haven't been to our committee before. So, but you are an ex officio member, and so welcome.
Well, thank you.
And I guess he'll be seeing me after committee. No, I don't know. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good luck with that meeting, by the way. I remember this discussion from the last couple of years, and perhaps the study was where we punted it to, but I thought we'd solved something. But I apologize, Mr. Chair, if all we did was punt it to a study, and now we're back again. But I'm going to tell you two brief stories that maybe can illustrate some of the problem we have here, and I don't even know if I have an idea for you, except I'm thinking of two. One is several years ago. The statute of limitations is up now, so I can talk about it. My son knocked down a power pole on a Minnesota highway, and my insurance company that fixed my pickup truck said, what about the appendage he hit? You know, we usually pay to put those back up, too. I made no less than 8 phone calls trying to track down who could tell me how much that light pole cost. And between the patrol and MnDOT, nobody would give me any satisfaction. So finally, I called the insurance guy and said, I give up. He said, okay, but just know that it's in your policy, and we routinely cover these things. So I just lay that out there for some consideration, that perhaps there are a lot of people in this whole discussion, Mr. Chair, that should be getting their heads together and talking about how we can compensate for not only police, fire, and emergency response, but just fixing things like traffic lights and traffic signs and so on that are recoverable as well. After I had tried to be a good sport and 8 phone calls over several days, I gave up. The other one was I had an incident at the airport in South St. Paul. Now, that's a city airport, and it's its own cost center. It's actually a profit center for the city. And some vandals broke in and did some mischief, started a little fire and some other things. And I got there just after they cleared out. And so I realized the fire was out, but I was really, of course, pretty shocked, disgusted, angry. And so I called the police, knowing the first thing my insurance guy would want would be a police file number. So the policeman showed up, took a look around, determined there was no immediate life or limb damage, and gave me a police report and helped me pick up some pieces and rearrange some stuff. Then the airport manager came down, and while he was standing there, no less than 3 other city functions came by. A fire truck came by, then the arson investigator came by, and then a detective came by. And after they all left, the city manager said to me, not the airport guy, he said, well, He said, they know that I have money in my budget. Every one of those just dinged the airport fund several hundred dollars for a call for service, even though all I ever did was call and ask for the police officer to come by. So I'm telling you that just to instruct us about one of the other sides of this discussion, that is, if we create a pot of money, one of the things we should be sure of is that other departments don't look at it like, well, here, this helps our budget. Let's all send guys over there, and every one of them gets to send the airport fund an invoice for services rendered, whether they were required or not. Having said all that, the idea that we have blockers and people on the highway protecting accident scenes and fire scenes and so on is an important one. However, Mr. Chair, I want to caution us that we don't create a revenue stream that finds ways to fund volunteer fire departments or police responders and things like that, because that is becoming more problematic, particularly in the suburban areas. My own city is struggling with how to keep the volunteer fire department alive and vital and funded. So I just want to throw some cautionary notes out there as we consider this. I'm glad we're not taking action on it today. Having said all that, though, there are several places, not just the east side of town, but I'm thinking coming out of Sioux Falls, coming out of Fargo, we have a lot of traffic and small town fire departments responsible for grass fires or incidents on interstates, and this is something that we should probably create a policy on how we can compensate these small town departments for their response on the interstate system, particularly when they're not directly tied to the transportation system like the state patrol is. Trying to think if I could even form a question for you other than just give the committee some food for thought as we move ahead, Mr. Chairman, that one is we want to be careful we don't start transferring budgets around. The other is that somehow within MnDOT and the patrol there is room for more coordination to recover costs that could be recovered and paid for by the insurance that we carry anyhow.
Yes, thank you, Representative Beard. Mr. Stanley, did you
Yes, sir.
Mr. Want to respond?
Chair, these calls are 911 generated calls only, and I believe by putting a cap on things too, that would prevent such a response from different agencies that would be attempting to bill. As far as grass fires on the highway, the state has something in place right now that pays for fire response for grass fires on the highway, so that wouldn't be an additional thing to this bill. So hopefully that answered some of your questions.
And Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to see how you spent $10,000 to get 13 pages. I guess I'm a little disappointed that we spent this much money and this is what we got. And then I'm just to be clear, this money would come out of the Trunk Highway Fund. Is that what we're...
That would be my understanding, but that your understanding as well.
And
yes, Mr. Chair.
Is there any guesstimate as to how much per year this program would cost the Trunk Highway Fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, we have not got a fiscal note on it yet.
All right, thank you.
Representative Blumer, did you want it to...
Yeah, I did.
And I apologize, we don't have a fiscal note yet, but we should probably get that, and I think just with the delay in jacketing and everything. But there has been actually some pretty significant studying done, and I think we're looking at about $250,000 would be an approximation of what we're looking for.
Thank you, Representative Blumer. Are there additional questions? So again, we're not taking action on this bill. We had a couple bills I would say today are works in progress, and but it's always helpful to have the committee look at these, and we always want to afford members the opportunity to come with their ideas, and so we appreciate that as well, Representative Lomer. And as this develops, and you're doing a good job getting the stakeholders together, and then as you move forward, we'll look forward to potentially getting a bill from you in the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, members. So just a couple of announcements before we adjourn. It seems like everyone's rested and ready to go based on the hearing today. And that's a good thing because we will have a busy week next week. So I wanted to just lay out for you our tentative schedule. I had a chance to talk with Representative Beard about it, and I hope it'll afford everybody enough time to digest this big bill and get your amendments in and debate it and participate in it. So right now we're looking at posting this bill on Friday. I can't say exactly what time of day, but you know, we will post this bill on Friday. I'm going to have a chance to brief the DFL members. There's an opportunity not only to brief you, Representative Beard, but any of your caucus members, you know, before this goes public. I'm happy to do that as well. And then we'll walk through the bill on Monday, and I don't know if we have a time yet scheduled for that. Oh, in the evening. We have to meet in the evening. I'm sorry about that. I guess there's a room issue, so... and then during the day on Tuesday, we'll actually then vote on amendments and vote this bill out of committee. That would be my goal on Tuesday. It does have to go, this is the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill, it does have to go to taxes and, I keep divulging things about this bill. There actually may be additional tax revenue, maybe, in this legislation. So it has to go to taxes and then to Ways and Means, and then on to the floor. So I hope that the weekend and Monday will give everybody enough time to familiarize yourselves with the bill. Again, we're going to have a very thorough walkthrough with our staff, and you know, I'll be somewhat flexible on amendments just because of the import of this bill in the relatively compressed time space. So, again, DFL members, you'll be briefed. Republican members, if you want to be, I'm happy to be accessible to anybody about this, either in a group or individually. Again, I don't think there's a lot of surprises. We've been talking about our Corridors for Commerce initiative, which I'm going to brief you on tomorrow in the committee, and that is a new funded program to deal with some of these corridors we've been hearing about, and of course we'll have the sales tax, which we've talked about. So those are the two big ticket items, but you know, there'll be other things as well, and just about everything has been vetted in the committee. I will say, just on the record, the one thing that's still being worked on is some governance issues around the metropolitan sales tax, and again, I've been in contact with Representative Beard about that. We have both the Met Council and CTIP that will be you know, eligible to receive money under that program. So we're looking at the governance. And that is the one part that we haven't really talked yet about in the committee, but I imagine will take up quite a bit of our debate time on Tuesday. So with that, are there any questions about our process here for the bill? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on Monday night, is that when you'll take public testimony on the bill? And then I'm just a little concerned. You didn't say what time we're meeting on Tuesday. But it's a very short turnaround time for amendments. If we have testimony on Monday night, it raises issues.
I'm going to consult with Mr. Scheer about that. I have some concerns about that as well, but we'll try to resolve that by the end of the day so that we have enough opportunity to give notice to the public so that they can weigh in. Again, it will be available on Friday. So, Monday evening may be an appropriate time to do that. But are you saying, Representative Holbrook, that may be a little too short notice?
Well, no, Mr. Chair, I think if you post on Friday and ask for testimony on Monday night, I don't see a problem with that. My problem is that if we have testimony on Monday evening and issues are raised about the bill, and say we come back Tuesday at 10 to mark it up, that's a very short turnaround time for amendments. You know, unless Mr. Burris is going to be here most of the night, Monday night, and I just think, I don't know what your turnaround time is there, but you could conceivably be in a situation where you only have 12, 14 hours from the time you take public testimony till the time you do markup. That seems a little tight.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, and I'm talking with our staff here. We are meeting on in the afternoon on Tuesday, but I'm going to be flexible. I mean, again, this is an important bill, and it needs to be vetted not only in the committee but in the public. And so if we need to go into Tuesday evening or possibly Wednesday, we'll take the time to do it right. So, Representative Beard.
And thank you. Thank Representative Holbert for your comments. Mr. Chair, for keeping me as the lead in the loop all along, I just want to tell the committee that has been the case. I too was going to express the concern that if things did come up, how about can we have an extra day, or even waiving the deadline for, you know, the 24-hour rule for amendments is going to be tight just on a practical matter. Having walked this path, I can empathize with you, but also with folks who are trying to make a good bill better, if I can use that phrase. So if it does take until a Wednesday meeting to clean some things up, I would encourage you to consider that, mostly just from a staff and from doing thoughtful amendments. Of course, the usual amendments that would come up just to make statements and points, we can have those already off the Friday bill, but the Monday night testimony would be the one I think that would give us the most concern. So if you can give us some room and some accommodation on that, that would be great.
Yeah, I think these are all really valid points, and again, I don't see a huge issue with going into Wednesday if that's the will of the committee. So, so just review Friday, bill out, Monday evening, walk through and public testimony. Tuesday at 2:15, we'll start our process. I think we'll be flexible on amendments, and I think partly for the good of the committee and you folks having enough time to get amendments in, but I also want to make sure that our staff, again, just really the last week and even during break, worked really, really hard on this. And so I want to thank again Andrew and Matt, Mr. Lee and Mr. Burris, for just really being so stellar, and next week will be tough for them too. So part of why I want to have as much time as possible will be to make sure that they can get their work done and do it well, as they have done all along. So with that, thank you. And we have, again, a couple more informational items I want to bring to the committee tomorrow. DFLers, I would like to just have a very brief meeting with you in 500 North. Again, very brief. I know people have to move on to lunch and other things, but if we could just get together shortly after that and shortly after this meeting, that would be great. 500 North for the DFL. Thanks so much, everybody. We're adjourned.